I dump out my tennis bag, pull out the rest of the rackets, each one worth hundreds of dollars, and pass them around.
Here, help yourselves. I sure as hell won't be needing them.
Then, reveling in how much lighter my tennis bag feels, I walk to the hotel where Philly and I are staying. I sit on one bed, and Philly sits on the other, just like old times, in more ways than one. I tell him I've had it. I can't do this anymore. He doesn't argue. He understands. Who better to understand? We knuckle down to details, making a plan. How to tell Nick, how to tell my father, how I can earn a living.
What do you want to do instead of playing tennis?
I don't know.
We go out for dinner, talk it over, analyze where I stand financially, a few hundred dollars above zero. We joke that we're getting close to potato and lentil soup territory. Back at the hotel, the phone in our room is flashing. I have one message. The organizers of a tennis exhibition in North Carolina phoned to say a player canceled on them. They want to know if I can play. If I do, they'll guarantee me $2,000. Philly agrees it would be nice to walk away from tennis with a little coin in my pocket.
Okay, I say. One last tournament. I better get some more rackets.
In the first round, I draw a kid named Michael Chang. I grew up playing him. I played him all through juniors, and I've never lost to him. I've never even had problems with him. Also, he's only 15, 2 years younger than I. He comes up to my navel. So this is just what the doctor ordered for my bruised psyche, a preordained beatdown. I walk onto the court, smiling. Chang, however, has undergone some kind of metamorphosis since our last meeting. He's made a quantum leap in his game, and now he plays like a flea on speed. It takes everything I've got to beat him. Still, I do beat him. My first win in months. I decide to postpone my retirement. Just a few more weeks. I tell Philly I want to go to Stratton Mountain, where I did well last year. Stratton will be a fitting place for my last hurrah. We fly up to Vermont with two fellow players, Peter Doohan and Kelly Everenden. Kelly says he grabbed the Stratton draw right before we left.
Anyone want to hear who he'll be playing?
I do.
No, Andre, you don't.
Uh-oh. Who did I draw?
Luke Jensen.
Fuck.
Luke's the best junior in the world. By far the most promising kid on the tour. I sink in my seat and watch the clouds. Should have quit while I was ahead. Should have retired after Chang.
Luke serves both lefty and righty, which is why they call him Dual Hand Luke, and he can bring it 130 miles an hour from either side. But today, against me, his first serve is off, and I cane his second. I'm more surprised than he is when I scrape by him in three sets and advance. Next up is Pat Cash, who just won Wimbledon, 12 days after I met my demise on Graveyard Court. Cash is a machine, a finely tuned athlete who moves well and covers the net like a hydra. I don't even think about beating him, only about holding my own. But in the early going, I find that he doesn't have a lot of top on his ball, so I'm getting nice, clean, eye-level looks, hitting one winner after another. Since I have no chance to win, since I want only to be credible, I'm free, loose, and this makes Cash tight. He appears shocked by what's unfolding. He's missing first serves, which lets me cheat in a half step, put everything I've got behind my return. Every time I hit a ball past him, Cash glares across the net with an expression that says, "This wasn't in the plan. You're not supposed to be doing this." Foolishly, somewhat arrogantly, he spends more and more time at the net looking surprised, rather than going back to the baseline and thinking up a new strategy. After one of my better returns, he hits a so-so volley, and I pass him again. He stands with his hands on his hips, staring at me, radiating a sense of injustice. Keep staring, I think. Keep it up. Toward the end, he's giving me painfully easy targets, making his ball so beautifully hittable, so marvelously strikeable, that it all seems unfair. I have a legit chance of hitting a winner on every point. I just wanted to leave a mark, but I'm leaving a gash. I score a shocking upset, 7-6, 7-6. Stratton Mountain, I conclude, is my magic mountain, my anti-Wimbledon. Last year, I played above my level here. Now, I'm playing twice as well. The setting is breathtaking, laid back, and quintessentially American. Unlike those snooty Brits, these Strattonites know me, or at least the idealized me I want them to know. They don't know about my struggles of the last 12 months, about my giving rackets to homeless men, about my pending retirement. And if they knew, they wouldn't hold it against me. They cheered me during my match with Jensen, but after I outclassed Cash, they adopt me. This guy is our guy. This guy does well here. Inspired by their raucous encouragement, I reach the semis against Ivan Lendl, who's ranked number 1, my biggest match ever. My father flies in from Vegas. An hour before the match, Lendl is walking around the locker room wearing only his tennis shoes. Seeing him so relaxed, so remarkably nude, right before facing me, I know what's coming. The beatdown to end all beatdowns. I lose in 3 sets. Still, I walk away feeling encouraged, because I won the 2nd set. For 30 minutes, I gave the best in the world all he wanted. I can build on that. I feel good. That is, until I see what Lendl has to say about me in the newspapers. Asked about my game, he sniffs, "A haircut and a forehand." Chapter 9. I finish 1987 with a bang. I win my first tournament as a pro in Itaparica, Brazil. All the more impressive because I do it before a crowd of initially hostile Brazilians. After I beat their top player, Luis Matar, the fans don't seem to hold a grudge. In fact, they make me an honorary Brazilian. They rush the court, hoist me on their shoulders, throw me in the air. Many have come to the arena straight from the beach. They're slathered with cocoa butter, and consequently, so am I. Women in bikinis and thongs cover me with kisses. Music plays, people dance. Someone hands me a bottle of champagne and tells me to spray it into the crowd. The carnival atmosphere is the perfect complement to my inner Mardi Gras. I finally broke through. I won 5 matches in a row. To win a slam, I realize with some alarm, I'll need to win 7. A man hands me the winner's check. I have to look twice at the number. In the amount of $90,000. With the check still folded in my jeans pocket, I stand 2 days later in my father's living room and employ a bit of remedial psychology. "Pops," I say, "how much do you think I'm going to make next year?"
"Ho-ho," he says, beaming. "Millions."
"Good. Then you won't mind if I buy a car." He frowns.
"Checkmate."
I know just the kind I want. A white Corvette with all the extras. My father insists that he and my mother go with me to the dealership to make sure the salesman doesn't screw me. I can't say no. My father is my landlord and keeper. I no longer live full-time at the Bolotari Academy, so once again I live under my father's roof, and thus under his control. I'm traveling the world, making good money, winning a measure of fame, and yet my old man essentially keeps me on an allowance. It's inappropriate, but hell, my whole life is inappropriate. I'm only 17, not ready to live on my own, barely ready to stand alone on a tennis court. And yet, I was just in Rio, holding a girl in a thong with one hand and a $90,000 check with the other. I'm an adolescent who's seen too much, a man-child without a checking account. At the car dealership, my father goes back and forth with the salesman, and the negotiation quickly turns contentious. Why am I not surprised? Every time my father makes a new offer, the salesman walks off to consult his manager. My father clenches and unclenches his fists. The salesman and my father eventually agree on a price. I'm seconds from owning my dream car. My father puts on his glasses, gives the paperwork a last look. He runs his finger down the itemized list of charges.
Wait, what's this? A charge for $49.99?
Small fee for the paperwork, the salesman says.
Ain't my fucking paper. That's your fucking paper. Pay for your own fucking paper.
The salesman doesn't care for my father's tone. Hard words are exchanged. My father gets that look in his eye, the same look he had before dropping the trucker. Just the sight of all these cars is giving him the old road rage. Pops, the car costs $37,000, and you're flipping out about a $50 fee?
They're screwing you, Andre. They're screwing me. The world is trying to screw me.
He storms out of the salesman's office and into the main showroom, where the managers sit along a high counter. He screams at them.
You think you're safe back there? You think you're safe behind that counter? Why don't you come out from behind there?
His dukes are up. He's ready to fight five men at once. My mother puts an arm around me and says the best thing we can do now is go outside and wait. We stand on the sidewalk and watch my father's tirade through the plate glass window of the dealership. He's pounding the desk. He's waving his hands. It's like watching a terrible silent movie. I'm mortified, but also slightly envious. I wish I possessed some of my father's rage. I wish I could tap into it during tough matches. I wonder what I could do in tennis if I could access that rage and aim it across the net. Instead, whatever rage I have, I turn on myself. Mom, I ask, how do you take it? All these years? Oh, she says, I don't know. He hasn't gone to jail yet, and nobody's killed him yet. I think we're pretty lucky, all things considered. Hopefully we'll get through this incident without either of those two things happening and move on. Along with my father's rage, I wish I had a fraction of my mother's calm. Philly and I go back to the dealership the next day. The salesman hands me the keys to my new Corvette, but treats me with pity. He says I'm nothing like my father, and though he means it as a compliment, I feel vaguely offended. Driving home, the thrill of my new Corvette is dampened. I tell Philly that things are going to be different from now on. Weaving in and out of traffic, gunning the engine, I tell him, the time has come. I need to take control of my money. I need to take control of my fucking life. I'm running out of steam in long matches. And for me, every match is long, because my serve is average. I can't serve my way out of trouble. I get no easy points off my serve, so every opponent takes me the full 12 rounds. My knowledge of the game is improving, but my body is breaking down. I'm skinny, brittle, and my legs give out quickly, followed in short order by my nerve. I tell Nick that I'm not fit enough to compete with the best in the world. He agrees. Legs are everything, he says. I find a trainer in Vegas, a retired military colonel named Lenny. Tough as burlap, Lenny curses like a sailor and walks like a pirate, the result of being shot in a long-ago war he doesn't like to talk about. After 1 hour with Lenny, I wish someone would shoot me. Few things give Lenny more pleasure than abusing me and hurling obscenities at me in the process. In December 1987, the desert turns unseasonably cold. The blackjack dealers wear Santa hats. The palm trees are strung with lights. The hookers on the strip wear Christmas ornaments for earrings. I tell Perry I can't wait for this new year. I feel strong. I feel as if I'm starting to get tennis. I win the first tournament of 1988 in Memphis, and the ball sounds alive as it leaves my racket. I'm growing into my forehand. I'm hitting the ball through opponents. Each one turns to me with a look that says, "Where the hell did that come from?" I notice something on the faces of the fans, too. The way they watch me and ask for my autograph, the way they scream as I enter an arena, makes me uncomfortable, but also satisfies something deep inside me, some hidden craving I didn't know was there. I'm shy, but I like attention. I cringe when fans start dressing like me, but I also dig it. Dressing like me in 1988 means wearing denim shorts. They're my signature. They're synonymous with me, mentioned in every article and profile. Oddly, I didn't choose to wear them. They chose me. It was 1987 in Portland, Oregon. I was playing the Nike International Challenge, and Nike reps invited me up to a hotel suite to show me the latest demos and clothing samples. McEnroe was there, and of course he was given first choice. He held up a pair of denim shorts and said, "What the fuck are these?" My eyes got big. I licked my lips and thought, "Whoa, those are cool. If you don't want those, Mac, I've got dibs." The moment Mac set them aside, I scooped them up. Now I wear them at all my matches, as do countless fans. Sports writers murder me for it. They say I'm trying to stand out. In fact, as with my mohawk, I'm trying to hide. They say I'm trying to change the game. In fact, I'm trying to prevent the game from changing me. They call me a rebel, but I have no interest in being a rebel. I'm only conducting an everyday, run-of-the-mill teenage rebellion. Subtle distinctions, but important. At heart, I'm doing nothing more than being myself. And since I don't know who that is, my attempts to figure it out are scattershot and awkward, and, of course, contradictory. I'm doing nothing more than I did at the Boletari Academy, bucking authority, experimenting with identity, sending a message to my father, thrashing against the lack of choice in my life. But I'm doing it on a grander stage. Whatever I'm doing, for whatever reasons, it strikes a chord. I'm routinely called the savior of American tennis, whatever that means. I think it has to do with the atmosphere at my matches. Besides wearing my outfits, fans come sporting my hairdo. I see my mullet on men and women. It looks better on the women. I'm flattered by the imitators, embarrassed, thoroughly confused. I can't imagine all these people trying to be like Andre Agassi, since I don't want to be Andre Agassi. Now and then I start to explain this in an interview, but it never comes out right. I try to be funny, and it falls flat or offends someone. I try to be profound, and I hear myself making no sense. So I stop, fall back on pat answers and platitudes, tell journalists what they seem to want to hear. It's the best I can do. If I can't understand my motivations and demons, how can I hope to explain them to journalists on deadline? To make matters worse, journalists write down exactly what I say, while I'm saying it, word for word, as if this represented the literal truth. I want to tell them, "Hold it, don't write that down. I'm only thinking out loud here. You're asking about the subject I understand least, me. Let me edit myself, contradict myself." But there isn't time. They need black and white answers, good and evil, simple plot lines in 700 words, and then they're on to the next thing. If I had time, if I were more self-aware, I would tell journalists that I'm trying to figure out who I am, but in the meantime, I have a pretty good idea of who I'm not. I'm not my clothes. I'm certainly not my game. I'm not anything the public thinks I am. I'm not a showman simply because I come from Vegas and wear loud clothes. I'm not an enfant terrible, a phrase that appears in every article about me. I think you can't be something you can't pronounce. And, for heaven's sake, I'm not a punk rocker. I listen to soft, cheesy pop like Barry Manilow and Richard Marx. Of course, the key to my identity, the thing I know about myself but can't bring myself to tell journalists, is that I'm losing my hair. I wear it long and fluffy to conceal its rapid departure. Only Philly and Perry know, because they're fellow sufferers. In fact, Philly recently flew to New York to meet with an owner of Hair Club for Men to buy himself a few toupees. He's finally given up on the headstands. He phones to tell me about the astonishing variety of toupees the Hair Club offers. It's a hair smorgasbord, he says. It's like the salad bar at Sizzler, only all hair. I ask him to pick one up for me. Every morning I find a little more of my identity on my pillow, in my sink, in my drain. I ask myself, you're going to wear a hairpiece? During tournaments? I answer, what choice do I have? At Indian Wells in February 1988, I blaze my way to the semis, where I meet Boris Becker from West Germany, the most famous tennis player in the world. He cuts an imposing figure, with a shock of hair the color of a new penny, and legs as wide as my waist. I catch him at the peak of his powers, but win the first set. Then I lose the next two, including a hard, tough third. We walk off the court glowering at each other like rutting bulls. I promise myself I won't lose to him the next time we meet. In March, at Key Biscayne, I face an old schoolmate from the Bolitari Academy, Aaron Crickstein. We're often compared to each other because of our connection with Nick and our precocious skills. I'm up 2-0 and then wear out. Crickstein wins the next 2 sets. As the 5th set starts, I'm cramping. I'm still not where I need to be, physically, to reach the next level. I lose. I go to Isle of Palms, near Charleston, and win my 3rd tournament. In the middle of the tournament, I turn 18. The tournament director rolls a cake out to center court, and everyone sings. I've never liked birthdays. No one ever took note of my birthday when I was growing up. But this feels different. I'm legal, everyone keeps saying. In the eyes of the law, you're a grown-up. Then the law is an ass. I go to New York City, the Tournament of Champions, a significant milestone because it's a clash of the top players in the world. Once more, I square off against Chang, who's developed a bad habit since we last met. Every time he beats someone, he points to the sky. He thanks God, credits God, for the win, which offends me. That God should take sides in a tennis match, that God should side against me, that God should be in Chang's box, feels ludicrous and insulting. I beat Chang and savor every blasphemous stroke. Then I take revenge on Crickstein. In the final, I face Slobodan Živojinović, a Serb better known for his doubles play. I beat him in straight sets. I'm winning more often. I should be happy. Instead, I'm uptight, because it's over. I've enjoyed a triumphant hard court season. My body wants to keep playing on hard courts, but clay season is starting. The sudden switch from one surface to another changes everything. Clay is a different game. Thus, your game must become different, and so must your body. Instead of sprinting from side to side, stopping short and starting, you must slide and lean and dance. Familiar muscles now play supporting roles. Dormant muscles dominate. It's painful enough, under the best of circumstances, that I don't know who I am. To suddenly become a different person, a clay person, adds another degree of frustration and anxiety. A friend tells me that the 4 surfaces in tennis are like the four seasons. Each asks something different of you. Each bestows different gifts and exacts different costs. Each radically alters your outlook, remakes you on a molecular level. After three rounds of the Italian Open in May 1988, I'm no longer Andre Agassi, and I'm no longer in the tournament. I go to the 1988 French Open expecting more of the same. Walking into the locker room at Roland Garros, I see all the clay experts leaning against the walls, leering. Dirt rats, Nick calls them. They've been here for months, practicing, waiting for the rest of us to finish hard courts and fly into their clay lair. Disorienting as the new surface is, Paris itself is more of a shock to the system. The city has all the same logistical problems of New York and London, the large crowds and cultural anomalies, but with an added language barrier. Also, the presence of dogs in restaurants unsettles me. The first time I walk into a cafe on the Champs-Élysées, a dog raises its leg and unleashes a stream of pee against the table next to mine. Roland Garros provides no escape from the strangeness. It's the only place I've ever played that reeks of cigars and pipes. While I'm serving, at a critical point in a match, a finger of pipe smoke curls under my nose. I want to find the person smoking that pipe and admonish him, and yet I don't want to find that person because I can't imagine what sort of gnarled hobbit is sitting in an outdoor tennis match puffing on a pipe. Despite my unease, I managed to beat my first three opponents. I even beat the great clay master Guillermo Perez Roldan in the quarterfinal. In the semis, I run into Mats Wielander. He's ranked number three in the world, but to my mind, he's the player of the moment. When one of his matches is on TV, I stop whatever I'm doing and watch. He's on his way to an astounding year. He's already won the Australian Open and is the favorite to win this tournament. I manage to take him to a fifth set, then lose 6-0, cramping badly. I remind Nick that I'm skipping Wimbledon. I say, why switch to grass and expend all that energy? Let's take a month off, rest, get ready for the hard courts of summer. He's more than happy not to go to London. He doesn't like Wimbledon any more than I do. Besides, he wants to hurry back to the U.S. and find me a better trainer. Nick hires a Chilean strongman named Pat, who never asks me to do anything he's not willing to do himself, which I respect. But Pat also has a habit of spitting on me when he talks and leaning over me while I'm lifting weights, drizzling sweat on my face. I feel as if I should show up for Pat's workout sessions in a plastic poncho. The mainstay of Pat's training regimen is a brutal daily run up and down a hill outside Vegas. The hill is remote and sunbaked and gets hotter as you near the top, as if it's an active volcano. It's also an hour from my father's house, which seems unnecessarily far. Nothing like driving to Reno for a run. Pat insists, however, that this hill is the answer to all my physical problems. When we get to the base and pile out of the car, he starts running straight up and orders me to follow. Within minutes, I'm holding my side, sweat rolling off me. By the time we reach the summit, I can't breathe. According to Pat, this is good. This is healthy. A battered truck appears one day as Pat and I crest the hill. An ancient Native American man climbs out. He comes toward us with a pole. If he wants to kill me, I won't be able to fend him off because I can't lift my arms. And I won't be able to run away because I can't draw breath. The man asks, "What are you doing here?"
"We're training. What are you doing here?"
"Catching me some rattlesnakes."
"Rattlesnakes? There are rattlesnakes out here?"
"There's training out here?"
When I stop laughing, the Indian says, more or less, that I must have been born with a horseshoe up my ass, because this is Rattlesnake Fucking Hill. He catches 12 rattlers every day on this hill, and he expects to catch 12 more this morning. It's a flat-out miracle that I haven't stepped on one, big and plump and ready to strike. I look at Pat and feel an urge to spit on him. In July, I go to Argentina as one of the youngest men ever to play for the U.S. Davis Cup team. I play well against Martin Haite from Argentina, and the crowd gives me its grudging respect. I'm leading 2-0, ahead 4-0 in the third, waiting for Haite's serve. I'm hunched against the cold because it's the dead of winter in Argentina. The temperature must be 30 degrees. Haite hits a let serve, then hits a bending, unreturnable serve that I reach up and catch with my hand. A riot breaks out. The crowd thinks I'm trying to show up their countrymen, disrespecting him. They boo me for several minutes. The next day's newspapers kill me. Rather than defend myself, I react with truculence. I say I've always wanted to do something like that. The truth is, I was just cold and not thinking. I was being stupid, not cocky. My reputation takes a major hit. The crowd at Stratton Mountain welcomes me days later, however, like a prodigal. I play to please them. I play to thank them for banishing the memory of Argentina. Something about these people, these emerald mountains, this Vermont air, I win the tournament. I wake soon after to discover that I'm number 4 in the world, but I'm too spent to celebrate. Between Pat and Davis Cup and the grind of the tour, I'm sleeping 12 hours a night. I fly to New York in the late summer to play a minor tournament in New Jersey, a tune-up for the 1988 U.S. Open. I reach the final and face Tarango. I beat him soundly, a delicious victory, because I can still close my eyes and see Tarango cheating me when I was 8. My first loss. I'll never forget. Each time I hit a winner, I think, fuck you, Jeff. Fuck you. At the U.S. Open, I reach the quarters. I'm due to face Jimmy Connors. Before the match, I approach him meekly in the locker room and remind him that we once met. In Las Vegas, I was 4. You were playing at Caesar's Palace. We hit some balls together? Nope, he says. Oh. Well, actually, we met again, several times, when I was 7. I used to deliver rackets to you. My father strung your rackets whenever you came to town, and I'd bring them to you at your favorite restaurant on the Strip. Nope, he says again, then lies back on a bench and pulls a long white towel over his legs and closes his eyes. Dismissed. This jibes with everything I've heard about Connors from other players. Asshole, they say. Rude, condescending, egomaniac prick. But I thought he'd treat me differently. I thought he'd show me some love, given our long-time connection. Just for that, I tell Perry, I'm beating this guy in 3 easy sets, and he's going to win no more than 9 games. The crowd is pulling for Connors. It's the opposite of Stratton. Here, I'm cast as the bad guy. I'm the impertinent upstart who dares to oppose the elder statesman. The crowd wants Connors to defy the odds and Father Time, and I'm standing in the way of that dream scenario. Each time they cheer, I think, do they realize what this guy is like in the locker room? Do they know what his peers say about him? Do they have any concept of how he responds to a friendly hello? I'm cruising, winning easily, when a man in the upper bleachers calls out, "Come on, Jimmy! He's a punk! You're a legend!" The words hang in midair for a moment, bigger and louder than the Goodyear blimp overhead, and then 20,000 fans guffaw. Connors cracks a sly smile, nods, and hits a ball as a souvenir to the man who yelled. Now the crowd erupts, a standing ovation. Running on adrenaline and anger, I punk the legend in the final set, 6-1. After the match, I tell reporters about my pre-match prediction, and then they tell Connors. He says, I enjoy playing guys who could be my children. Maybe he's one of them. I spent a lot of time in Vegas. In the semis, I lose again to Lendl. I take him to a fourth set, but he's too strong. Trying to wear him out, I wear myself out. Despite the best efforts of Limping Lenny and Pat the Spitting Chilean, I'm not able to stay with a man of Lendl's caliber. I tell myself that when I get back to Vegas, the search must continue for someone, anyone, who can make me battle-ready. But no one can make me ready for the battle with the media, because it's not really a battle, it's a massacre. Each day brings another anti-Agassi screed in another magazine or newspaper, a dig from a fellow player, a diatribe from a sports writer, a fresh piece of libel served up as analysis. I'm a punk, I'm a clown, I'm a fraud, I'm a fluke. I have a high ranking because of a conspiracy, a cabal of networks and teenagers. I don't rate the attention I get because I haven't won a slam. Millions of fans like me, apparently. I get potato sacks full of fan mail, including naked pictures of women with their phone numbers scrawled along the margin. And yet, each day, I'm vilified because of my look, because of my behavior, because of no reason at all. I absorb the role of villain rebel, accept it, grow into it. The role seems like part of my job, so I play it. Before long, however, I'm being typecast. I'm to be the villain rebel forever, in every match and every tournament. I turn to Perry. I fly back east and visit him for a weekend. He's studying business at Georgetown. We go out for big dinners, and he takes me to his favorite local bar, the Tombs, and over beers, he does what Perry has always done. He reshapes my anguish, makes it more logical and articulate. If I'm a returner, he's a rewarder. First, he redefines the problem as a negotiation between me and the world. Then he clarifies the terms of the negotiation. He grants that it's horrible to be a sensitive person who's publicly excoriated every day, but he insists it's only temporary. There's a time limit to this torture. Things will get better, he says, the moment I start to win Grand Slams. Win? What's the point? Why should winning change people's minds about me? Win or lose, I'm still the same person. That's why I need to win? To shut people up? To satisfy a bunch of sports writers and reporters who don't know me? Those are the terms of this negotiation? Philly sees that I'm suffering, that I'm searching. He's searching too. He's been searching all his life, and recently he stepped up the search. He tells me he's been going to a church, or a kind of church, in an office complex on the west side of Vegas. It's non-denominational, he says, and the pastor is different. He drags me to the church, and I have to admit, he's right. The pastor, John Parenti, is different. He wears jeans, a t-shirt, and he has long, sandy brown hair. He's more surfer than pastor. He's unconventional, which I respect. He's, no other way to say it, a rebel. I also like his prominent aquiline nose, his sad canine eyes. Above all, I like the casual vibe of his service. He simplifies the Bible. No ego, no dogma, just common sense and clear thinking. Parenti is so casual, he doesn't want to be called Pastor Parenti. He insists we call him JP. He says he wants his church to feel unlike a church. He wants it to feel like a home where friends gather. He doesn't have any answers, he says. He just happens to have read the Bible a few dozen times, front to back, and he has some observations to share. I think he has more answers than he's letting on, and I need answers. I consider myself a Christian, but JP's church is the first one where I felt truly close to God. I attend with Philly every week. We time our arrival so that we walk in just as JP starts talking, and we always sit in the back, slouched low, so we don't get recognized. One Sunday, Philly says he wants to meet JP. I hang back. Part of me would like to meet JP too, but part of me is wary of strangers. I've always been shy, but the recent avalanche of bad press has made me borderline paranoid. Days later, I'm driving around Vegas, feeling gutted after reading the latest attacks on me. I find myself parked outside JP's church. It's late. All the lights are off, except one. I peer in the window. A secretary is doing some paperwork. I knock at the door and tell the woman I need to speak with JP. She says he's at home. She doesn't say where you should be. With a shaky voice, I ask if she could please phone him. I really need to talk to him. To somebody. She dials JP and hands me the receiver.
Hello?
He says. Hi, yes. You don't know me. My name is Andre Agassi. I'm a tennis player, and... Well, it's just...
I know you. I've seen you in church the last 6 months. I recognized you, of course. I just didn't want to bother you.
I thank him for his discretion, for respecting my privacy. I haven't been getting that kind of respect lately. I say, look, I wonder if we could spend some time together. Talk.
When?
Now?
Oh. Well, I guess I could come down to the office and meet you.
With all due respect, can I come to wherever you are? I have a fast car, and I think I can get there faster than you can get here. He pauses.
Okay,
he says. I'm there in 13 minutes. He meets me on his doorstep. Thanks for agreeing to see me. I feel like I have nowhere else to turn.
What is it that you need?
I wonder if we can just, get to know each other? He smiles.
Listen, he says. I don't do father figure real well.
I nod, laugh at myself. I say, right, right, but maybe you could give me some assignments, life assignments, reading assignments.
Like a mentor?
Yeah.
I don't do mentor real well either.
Oh.
Talking, listening, fellowship, those things I can do.
I frown.
Look, JP says, my life is as screwed up as the next guy's, maybe more. I can't offer much in the way of shepherding. I'm not that kind of pastor. If you're looking for advice, I'm sorry. If you're looking for a friend, that we can do, maybe.
I nod. He holds open the door, asks if I'd like to come in. But I ask if he'd like to go for a drive. I think better when I drive. He cranes his neck and sees my white Corvette. It looks like a small private plane parked in his driveway. The color drains a bit from his face. I drive JP all over Vegas, up and down the strip, then into the mountains that circle the town. I show him what the vet can do, open up the engine on a lonely stretch of highway, then open up myself. I tell him my story in a ragged and disorderly fashion, and he has Perry's knack for saying it all back to me, artfully reworded. He understands my contradictions and reconciles a few of them.
You're a kid who still lives with his parents, he says. But you're known around the planet. That's got to be hard. You're trying to express yourself freely and creatively and artistically, and you're slammed at every turn. That's very hard.
I tell him about the knock on me, that I've snuck up on my high ranking, that I've never beaten anyone good, that I've been lucky. Horseshoe up my ass. He says I'm experiencing backlash and never even got to enjoy the lash. I laugh. He says it must be bizarre to have strangers think they know me and love me beyond reason, while others think they know me and resent me beyond reason, all while I'm a relative stranger to myself. What makes it perverse, I tell him, is that it all revolves around tennis, and I hate tennis.
Right, sure. But you don't actually hate tennis.
Yes. Yes, I do. I talk about my father. I tell JP about the yelling, the pressure, the rage, the abandonment. JP gets a funny look on his face.
You do realize, don't you, that God isn't anything like your father? You know that, don't you?
I almost drive the Corvette onto the shoulder.
God, he says, is the opposite of your father. God isn't mad at you all the time. God isn't yelling in your ear, harping on your imperfections. That voice you hear all the time, that angry voice, that's not God. That's still your father.
I turn to him. Do me a favor. Say that again. He does, word for word. Say it once more. He does. I thank him. I ask about his own life. He tells me that he hates what he does. He can't abide being a pastor. He no longer wants to be responsible for people's souls. It's a round-the-clock job, he says, and it leaves him no time for reading and reflection. I wonder if this is a slight jab at me. He's also hounded by death threats. Prostitutes and drug pushers come to his church and reform, and then their pimps and junkies and families who've depended on that stream of income blame JP.
What do you think you'd like to do instead?
Actually, I'm a songwriter, a composer. I'd like to make music for a living. He says he's written a song, When God Ran. That's a huge hit on the Christian charts. He sings a few bars. He has a nice voice, and the song is moving. I tell him that if he wants it bad enough and works hard enough, he'll succeed. When I start talking like a motivational speaker, I know I'm tired. I look at my watch. 3 in the morning.
Wow, I say, stifling a yawn. If you don't mind, can you just drop me off at my parents' house? I live right up here at the corner, and I'm exhausted. I can't drive another minute. Take my car. Take yourself home. Bring it back to me when you can.
I don't want to take your car.
Why not? Fun car. Goes like the wind.
I see that, but what if I wreck it?
If you wreck it, as long as you're okay, I would laugh. I don't give a shit about the car.
How long do you want me to... I mean, when should I bring it back?
Whenever. He brings it back the next day.
Driving to church in this thing was awkward enough, he says, tossing me the keys. But, Andre, I officiated funerals. You cannot drive up to a funeral in a white Corvette.
I invite JP to Munich for Davis Cup. I look forward to Davis Cup because it's not about me, it's about country. I imagine it's as close as I'll ever get to playing on a team, so I expect the trip to be a pleasant diversion, the matches to be easy, and I want to share the experience with my new friend. Early on, I find myself pitted against Becker, who's attained godlike status in West Germany. The fans are bringing down the house, 12,000 Germans cheering as every swing, booing me. And yet, I'm unfazed, because I'm in a zone. Maybe not the zone, but my zone. I can't miss. Also, I promised myself months ago that I'd never again lose to Becker, and I'm making good on that promise. I jump out to a 2-set lead. JP and Philly and Nick are the only people cheering for me, and I can hear them. A fine day in Munich. Then I lose my concentration, followed by my confidence. I drop a game and head for my chair during the changeover, discouraged. Suddenly, several German officials are gabbling at me. They're calling me back onto the court. The game isn't over.
Come back, Mr. Agassi. Come back.
Becker giggles. The audience roars with laughter. I walk back onto the court, feeling my eyes throb. Once again, I'm at the Boletari Academy,
being humiliated by Nick in front of the other kids. I have enough trouble being laughed at in the press, but I can't handle being laughed at in person. I lose the game. I lose the match. Showered, climbing into a car outside the arena, I ignore JP and turn to Nick and Philly. I tell them, the first person who talks to me about tennis is fired. I sit on the balcony of my Munich hotel room, alone, staring out over the city. Without thinking, I begin lighting things on fire. Paper, clothes, shoes. For years, this has been one of my furtive ways of coping with extreme stress. I don't do it consciously. An impulse comes over me and I reach for the matches. Just as I've got a small bonfire going, JP appears. He watches, then calmly adds a piece of hotel stationery to my bonfire, then a napkin. I add the room service menu. We feed the bonfire for 15 minutes, neither of us saying a word. As the last flame dies down, he asks, "Do you want to go for a walk?" We wind our way through the beer gardens of downtown Munich. Everywhere we look, people are being boisterous, festive. They're drinking from 1-liter tankards, singing and laughing. The laughter gives me the shakes. We come to a large stone bridge with a cobblestone walkway. We cross. Far below is a rushing river. At the apex of the bridge, we stop. No one is around. The singing and laughter have subsided. We hear nothing but the rushing water. I stare into the river and ask JP, "What if I'm no good? What if today wasn't a bad day, but my best day? I'm always making excuses when I lose. I could have beaten him if such and such, if I'd wanted it, if I'd had my A game, if I'd gotten the calls. But what if I'm playing my best and I care and I want it, and I'm still not the best in the world?"
"Well, what if?"
"I think I'd rather die." I lean against the railing, sobbing. JP has the decency, the wisdom, to say and do nothing. He knows there is nothing to say, nothing to do, but wait for this fire to burn out. I face Karl Uwe Stieb, another German, the following afternoon. Spent, physically and emotionally, I play Stieb exactly the wrong way. Yes, I'm attacking his backhand, which is his weakest shot, but I'm doing it with pace. If I were to give him no pace, he'd have to generate his own, and his backhand would be much weaker. His greatest flaw would be on display. Using my pace, however, he can hit a low slice that stays down on this fast surface. I'm making him better than he is, all because I'm trying to hit bigger than I need to, trying to be perfect. With a cordial smile, Stieb accepts my gifts, settling into his legs and his Agassi-augmented backhand, having a marvelous time. Later, the captain of the Davis Cup team accuses me of tanking, as does a prominent sports writer. Part of the problem with my game in 1989 is my racket. I've always used a Prince, but Nick has convinced me to sign with a new company, Dunne. Why? Because Nick's got money troubles, and for delivering me to Dunne, he gets a lucrative contract for himself. "Nick," I tell him, "I love my Prince."
"You could play with a broomstick," he says. "It wouldn't matter."
Now, with the Dunne, I feel as if I am playing with a broomstick. I feel as if I'm playing left-handed, as if I've suffered a brain injury. Everything is slightly off. The ball doesn't listen to me. The ball doesn't do what I say. I'm in New York, hanging out with JP. It's well after midnight. We're sitting in a seedy deli with garish fluorescent lights and loud countermen arguing in several Eastern European languages. We're each having a cup of coffee, and I'm holding my head in my hands, telling JP over and over, when I hit the ball with this new racket, I don't know where it's going.
You'll find a solution, JP says.
How? What?
I don't know, but you will. This is a momentary crisis, Andre. One of many. As sure as we're sitting here, there will be others. Bigger, smaller, and everything in between. Treat this crisis as practice for the next crisis. And then, the crisis is resolved during a practice. Days later, I'm in Florida, hitting at the Bolitari Academy, and someone hands me a new prince. I hit 3 balls, just 3, and it's something like a religious experience. Every ball goes like a laser to the spot where I want it to go. The court opens before me like Xanadu. I don't care about any deals, I tell Nick. I can't sacrifice my life to a deal.
I'll handle it, he says.
He doctors a prince racket, stencils it to look like a Dane, and I cruise to several easy victories at Indian Wells. I lose in the quarters, but I don't care, because I have my racket back, my game back. The next day, 3 Dane execs descend on Indian Wells. This is unacceptable, they say. It's clear to everyone that you're playing with a doctored prince. You're going to ruin us. You're going to be liable for the destruction of our company. Your racket is going to be liable for the destruction of me. Seeing that I'm unrepentant and not budging, the Dane execs say they'll build me a better racket. They go away and duplicate a prince, just as Nick did, but make it look more convincing. I take my faux Dane to Rome and play a kid I recognize from juniors. Pete something. Sampras, I think. Greek kid from California. When I played him in juniors, I beat him handily. I was 10, he was 9. The next time I saw him was some months ago at a tournament. I can't recall which one. I was sitting on a beautiful grassy hill beside my hotel just after winning my match. Philly and Nick were sitting alongside me. We were stretched out, enjoying the fresh air and watching Pete, who'd just taken a beating in his match. He was on the hotel court for a post-match practice, and nearly every ball he hit looked bad. He missed 3 of every 4 swings. His backhand was awkward and one-handed, which was new. Someone had tinkered with his backhand, and it was clearly going to cost him a career.
This guy will never make it on the tour, Philly said.
He'll be lucky to qualify into tournaments, I said.
Whoever did that to his game should be ashamed, Nick said.
They should be indicted, Philly said. He has all the physical gifts. He's 6'1", moves great, but someone has turned him into a mess. Someone is responsible for that shit. Someone should pay. At first, I was taken aback by Philly's vehemence. Then I realized Philly was projecting. He was seeing himself in Pete. He knew what it was like to try and fail to make it on tour, particularly with an involuntary one-handed backhand. In Pete's plight, in Pete's fate, Philly saw his own. Now in Rome, I see that Pete has improved since that day, but not much. He has a big serve, but not extraordinary, not a Becker serve. He has a fast arm, good action, and easy motion, and comes close to his spots. He wants to ace you out wide, and when he misses, it's not by much. He's not one of those players who try to ace you out wide and serve it by mistake into your chest. His real problem comes after his serve. He's inconsistent. He can't keep 3 balls in a row between the lines. I beat him 6-2, 6-1, and as I walk off the court, I think to myself that he's got a long and painful slog ahead. I feel bad for the guy. He seems like a good soul, but I don't expect to see him again on the tour, ever. I go on to reach the final. I face Alberto Mancini. Strong, stocky, with tree trunk legs, he pounds the ball with tremendous weight, penetration, and a tornado spin that causes it to hit your racket like a medicine ball.
I have match point against him in the fourth set, but I lose the point, then fall apart. Somehow I lose the match. Back in my hotel, I sit in my room for hours watching Italian TV, setting things on fire. People, I think, don't understand the pain of losing in a final. You practice and travel and grind to get ready. You win for 1 week, 4 matches in a row. Or at a slam, 2 weeks, 6 matches. Then you lose that final match and your name isn't on the trophy. Your name isn't in the record books. You lost only once, but you're a loser. I go to the 1989 French Open, and in the third round, I face Courier, my schoolmate from the Bolitari Academy. I'm the chalk, the heavy favorite, but Courier scores the upset, then rubs my nose in it. He pumps his fist, glares at me and Nick. Moreover, in the locker room, he makes sure everyone sees him lacing up his running shoes and going for a jog. Message? Beating Andre just didn't provide enough cardio. Later, when Chang wins the tournament and thanks Jesus Christ for making the ball go over the net, I feel sickened. How could Chang, of all people, have won a slam before me? Again, I skip Wimbledon. I hear another chorus of jeers from the media. Agassi doesn't win the slams he enters, and then he skips the slams that matter most. But it feels like a drop in the ocean. I'm becoming desensitized. Even though I'm a punching bag for sports writers, big companies beg me to pose with their products. In the middle of 1989, one of my corporate sponsors, Canon, schedules a series of photo shoots, including one in the wilds of Nevada, in the Valley of Fire. I like the sound of that. I walk every day through a valley of fire. Since the ad campaign is for a camera, the director wants a colorful setting. Vivid, he says. Cinematic. He builds an entire tennis court in the middle of the desert, and as I watch the workmen, I can't help thinking of my father building a tennis court in his desert. I've come a long way. Or have I? For a full day, the director films me playing tennis by myself, the flame-red mountains and orange rock formations in the background. I'm weary, sunburned, ready for a break. But the director isn't done with me. He tells me to take off my shirt. I'm known for taking off my shirt in moments of teenage exuberance and throwing it into crowds. Then he wants to film me in a cave, hitting a ball at the camera as if to shatter the lens. Then, at Lake Mead, we film several scenes against the watery backdrop. It all seems silly, goofy, but harmless. Back in Vegas, we do a series of shots on the strip, then around a swimming pool. As luck would have it, they choose the pool at good old Cambridge Racquet Club. Finally, we set up for one last shot at a Vegas country club. The director puts me in a white suit, then has me drive up to the front portico in a white Lamborghini. "Step out of the car," he says. "Turn to the camera, lower your black sunglasses, and say, 'Image is everything.'" "Image is everything?" "Yes, image is everything." Between takes, I look around, and in the crowd of spectators, I see Wendy, the former ball girl, my childhood crush, all grown up. Now she's definitely come a long way since the Alan King tournament. She's carrying a suitcase. She's just dropped out of college, and she's just come home. "You were the first person I wanted to see," she says. She looks beautiful. Her brown hair is long, curly, and her eyes are impossibly green. She's all I can think about while the director is ordering me around. As the sun goes down, the director yells, "Cut! That's a wrap!" Wendy and I jump into my new Jeep, the doors and top off, and go roaring away like Bonnie and Clyde. Wendy says, "What was that slogan they kept making you say into the camera?" "Image is everything." "What's that supposed to mean?" "Beats me. It's for a camera company." Weeks later, I begin to hear this slogan twice a day, then six times a day, then 10. It reminds me of those Vegas windstorms, the kind that begin with a faint, ominous rustling of leaves, and ultimately turn into high-pitched gale-force three-day blows. Overnight, the slogan becomes synonymous with me. Sports writers liken this slogan to my inner nature, my essential being. They say it's my philosophy, my religion, and they predict it's going to be my epitaph. They say I'm nothing but image, I have no substance, because I haven't won a slam. They say the slogan is proof that I'm just a pitch man, trading on my fame, caring only about money and nothing about tennis. Fans at my matches begin taunting me with the slogan, "Come on, Andre, image is everything." They yell this if I show any emotion. They yell it if I show no emotion. They yell it when I win. They yell it when I lose. This ubiquitous slogan and the wave of hostility and criticism and sarcasm it sets off is excruciating. I feel betrayed by the advertising agency, the Canon execs, the sports writers, the fans. I feel abandoned. I feel the way I did when I arrived at the Bolotari Academy. The ultimate indignity, however, is when people insist that I've called myself an empty image, that I've proclaimed it, simply because I spoke the line in a commercial. They treat this ridiculous throwaway slogan as if it's my confession, which makes as much sense as arresting Marlon Brando for murder because of a line he uttered in The Godfather. As the campaign widens, as this insidious slogan creeps its way into every article about me, I change. I develop an edge, a mean streak. I stop giving interviews. I lash out at linesmen, opponents, reporters, even fans. I feel justified because the world is against me. The world is trying to screw me. I'm becoming my father. When crowds boo, when they yell, "Image is everything," I yell back, "As much as you don't want me here, that's how much I don't want to be here." In Indianapolis, after a particularly bad loss and a sonorous booing, a reporter asks me what went wrong. "You didn't seem like yourself today," he says with a smile that isn't a smile. "Something bothering you?" I tell him, in so many words, to kiss my ass. No one counsels me that you should never snap at reporters. No one bothers to explain that snapping, baring your fangs, makes reporters more rabid. Don't show them fear, but don't show them your fangs either. Even if someone were to give me this sensible advice, I don't know that I could take it. Instead, I hide. I act like a fugitive, and my accomplices in seclusion are Philly and JP. We go every night to an old coffee shop on the Strip, a place called the Peppermill. We drink bottomless cups of coffee and eat slabs of pie and talk and talk and sing. JP has made the leap from pastor to composer-musician. He's moved to Orange County and rededicated his life to music. Along with Philly, we belt out our favorite songs until the other customers at the Peppermill turn and stare. JP is also a frustrated comedian, a devotee of Jerry Lewis, and he slips in and out of slapstick routines that leave Philly and me weak from laughter. We then try to out-slapstick JP. We dance around the waitress, crawl along the floor, and eventually the three of us are laughing so hard that we can't breathe. I laugh more than I've laughed since I was a boy, and even though it's tinged with hysteria, the laughter has healing properties. For a few hours, late at night, laughter makes me feel like the old Andre, whoever that is. Chapter 10. Not far from my father's house is the sprawling concrete campus of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, which in 1989 is gaining a reputation for its sports teams. The basketball squad is a powerhouse, with NBA-ready stars, and the football team is vastly improved. The Runnin' Rebels are known for their speed and superb conditioning. Plus, they're the Rebels. That's my kind of mascot. Pat says there might be someone at UNLV who can help me get in shape when he's not in town. We drive to the campus one day and make our way to the gym, a new building that I find as daunting as the Sistine Chapel. So many perfect bodies, so many full-grown men. I'm 5'11", 148 pounds, and my Nike clothes hang off me. I tell myself this was a mistake. Apart from feeling woefully undersized, I still feel edgy in a school, any kind of school. Pat, who am I kidding? I don't belong here.
We're here, he says, spitting.
We find the office of the school's strength coach. I tell Pat to wait. I'll go in and talk to the guy. I poke my head in the doorway, and there, across the office, in the far corner, behind a desk the size of my Corvette, I see a real-life giant. He looks like the statue of Atlas fronting Rockefeller Center, which I saw during my first U.S. Open, except this Atlas has long black hair and black eyes as large and round as the weights neatly stacked in the gym. He looks as if he'll flatten the first person who disturbs him. I jump back through the doorway.
You go, Pat.
He walks in. I hear him say something. I hear a deep baritone rumble in response. It sounds like a truck engine. Then Pat calls to me. I hold my breath and again go through the doorway.
Hello,
I say.
Hello,
the giant says.
Yeah, well, my name is Andre Agassi. I play tennis, and, I live here in Vegas, and...
I know who you are.
He stands. He's 6 feet tall, with a chest at least 56 inches around. For a moment, I think he might tip the desk over in anger. Instead, he comes around from behind and extends his hand. The largest hand I've ever seen. A hand that goes with his shoulders, biceps, and legs. Also record setters, in my personal experience.
Gil Reyes, he says.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Reyes.
Call me Gil.
Okay, Gil. I know you must be very busy. I don't want to take up your time. I was just wondering, that is, Pat and I were wondering, if we could talk to you about using your facilities now and then. I'm really struggling to improve my conditioning.
Sure,
he says.
His voice makes me think of the bottom of the ocean and the core of the earth. But it's also a voice as soft as it is deep. He shows us around, introduces us to several student athletes. We talk about tennis, basketball, the differences, the similarities. Then the football team walks in.
Excuse me, Gil says. I need to speak with the fellas. Make yourself at home. Use whatever machines or weights you want to use. But please be careful and be discreet. Technically speaking, you know, it's against the rules.
Thank you.
Pat and I do a few bench presses, leg lifts, sit-ups. But I'm more interested in watching Gil. The football players gather before him and gaze up at him with awe. He's like a Spanish general addressing his conquistadors. He gives them their orders. You take this bench. You grab that machine. You that squat rack. While he's speaking, no one looks away. He doesn't demand their attention. He simply compels it. Lastly, he tells them to gather round, closer, reminds them that hard work is the answer, the only answer.
Everyone bring it in. Hands together. 1, 2, 3, Rebels!
They break, then fan out and hit the weights. I'm reminded how much better off I'd be on a team. Pat and I go back to the gym at UNLV every day, and while doing curls and bench presses, I can feel Gil keeping tabs on us. I sense that he's noting my bad form.
I sense that the other athletes are noticing, too. I feel amateurish and often want to leave, but Pat always stops me. After a few weeks, Pat needs to fly back east, family emergency. I knock at the door to Gil's office and tell him that Pat is gone, but he left a regimen for me to follow. I hand Gil the piece of paper with Pat's regimen and ask if he might be willing to help me go through it.
Sure, Gil says,
but he sounds put upon. With each exercise, Gil arches an eyebrow. He looks over Pat's regimen, turns the paper in his hands, frowns. I encourage him to tell me what's on his mind, but he only frowns more deeply. He asks,
"What's the point of this exercise?"
"I'm not sure."
"Tell me again, how long have you been doing this?"
"Long time." I beg him to speak his mind.
"I don't want to step on anybody's toes," he says. "I don't want to speak out of turn, but I can't lie to you. If somebody can write down your routine on a piece of paper, it isn't worth the piece of paper it's written on. You're asking me to put you through a workout here that leaves no room for where you are, how you're feeling, what you need to focus on. It doesn't allow for change."
That makes sense. "Could you help me? Maybe give me some tips?"
"Well, look, what are your goals?"
I tell him about my recent loss to Alberto Mancini from Argentina. He out-physicaled me, pushed me around like an old-time bully at the beach, kicking sand in my face. I had the match won. I had my foot on the man's neck, but I couldn't finish him off. I was serving for the match, and Mancini broke me, then won the tiebreak, then broke me three times in the fifth set. I had nothing left. I need to get strong so that I never let that happen again. Losing is one thing. Being outgunned is another. I can't bear that feeling anymore. Gil listens, not moving, not interrupting, soaking it all in.